Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is April 13th, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 301. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 301 removes the requirement that dental hygienists with expanded practice dental hygiene permits must enter into a collaborative agreement in order to conduct dental risk assessments and referral parameters. There's a dash 3 amendment which adds that dental hygiene includes pre-diagnostic risk assessment. It specifies that unless different criteria for referral of a patient or resident to dentist are included in an agreement between dental hygienists and dentists at least once a year, an expanded practice dental hygienist shall refer each patient available to treat patient or resident. It restores language stating that dental risk assessment and referral parameters are part of agreements between dentists and expanded practice dental hygienists. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, it's up to you either way.
Good.
Madam Chair, that's the wrong one. Thank you. Move that we adopt the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 301.
Senator Steinert Hayward moves that we adopt the dash 3 amendments. Is there any discussion, any opposition? Is there any opposition to clerk will call the roll. Might as well wait till Knopf sits it down.
Aye.
Aye.
Dash 3 amendments to 301. It's the expanded permit dental hygienist.
Aye.
Thank you.
Excuse. Aye. Amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 301 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 301 to the floor as amended with the dash 3s with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Steiner
Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 301 and open a work session on Senate Bill 608.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 608 establishes a 9-member palliative care and quality of life interdisciplinary action council in the Oregon Health Authority. It requires health facilities to establish a system for identifying patients or residents that could benefit from palliative care, provide information to patients and families, and facilitate access of, to appropriate palliative care. There is a dash 2 amendment which removes the palliative care consumer and professional information and education program. It permits instead of requires the Oregon Health Authority to publish certain information on its website limited to specified information, and it requires health care facilities to coordinate with patients, resident, or primary care provider if practicable. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 608.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves to adopt the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 608. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So adopted, and Senator Cruz is excused.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill to the floor as 608 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 608 as adopted with the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Motion carries, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 608 and open a work session on Senate Bill 905.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 905 adds a physician assistant to the Oregon Medical Board. It allows the physician assistant to be selected by the governor from a list of 3 to 5 candidates submitted by the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. There's a dash 1 amendment which permits the physician assistant to be retired. It appoints candidates for the year the term expires. It staggers the terms by 3 years, and it repeals the physician assistant committee. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Can I have
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 905.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves to adopt the dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? so adopted. Senator Cruz is excused.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 905 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 905 to the floor as amended with the dash ones to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Tom Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner
Hayward. Aye.
Senator Bill.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excuse. Aye. Motion passes. I'll carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 905. And colleagues, we're not moving Senate Bill 469, but it appears that we have a kumbaya between the hospitals and the Nurses Association, and I would like to have them at least come up and talk about what is in the amendment. And I think the amendments, are they out yet? No. And so, but because we're running on time, I think the committee should at least know what's in the amendments. And then we would carry it over to, let's see. Yeah, I'll open a public hearing or work session on Senate Bill 469. And we'll carry it over to Wednesday, maybe Monday, because we need to make sure that the hospitals and the nurses really understand that this is what they really asked for.
Good afternoon, Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. Sarah Basler on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the forthcoming amendment to Senate Bill 469, which we understand should be ready very shortly. You heard this issue in a public hearing in February, and since then we've been working very closely with the Hospital Association and our respective nurse leaders to discuss Senate Bill 469 to better understand each other's concerns and try to find common ground. I'm here today to tell you that we find it's been a very productive process leading to the amendment that should be out any minute, and ONA does enthusiastically support that amendment. As a reminder to the committee, Oregon's staffing law was first enacted in 2001, and Oregon remains one of a handful of states in the country to have a law about nurse staffing. Our law takes a collaborative approach, and it requires each hospital, each and every hospital in the state, to have a staffing committee that's an even balance of staff nurses and nurse managers. That collaborative approach is maintained in the proposal that we're bringing forward. Under the current law, the committee has a number of criteria to consider when making staffing plans, and the state, through a division of the Oregon Health Authority, has the responsibility to audit and investigate complaints. The forthcoming amendment includes a number of modifications to what you heard in February. There is a summary that I think is in OLIS now, which includes the key provisions of the current law as well as the changes proposed by the bill and what we're all hoping is in the amendment. Just a few of the highlights. We maintain the balance of the staffing committee in each hospital. And add some additional criteria for the staffing committees to consider when they're formulating staffing plans. In February, you heard us talk about a triggered set ratio in the case of a staffing committee coming to an impasse. Through our work with the Hospital Association, that is no longer part of, that won't be included in the amendment before you, but rather will be replaced with a mandatory mediation process. And that's in the case where a staffing committee really can't work together to approve a staffing plan. The state would be responsible for bringing in a mediator. That mediator would be responsible for helping the staffing committee approve a plan within 90 days and would have to consider the same factors that the staffing plan is required to be based on, such as the acuity of the patients and the skill mix of the nurses. Another huge issue that we've spent a lot of time working on since our meeting in February related to the ultimate authority of the staffing committee. The amendment will clearly state that the hospital must implement the plan approved by the committee, but does include some exemptions to that, some certain emergency situations in which it might not be possible for the plan approved by the committee to be implemented. The bill proposed and the amendment will modify a nurse staffing advisory board. This is a new entity, and we work together well to modify the membership and the responsibilities of that board. The goal is to have additional transparency and expertise around staffing, and this is a board that would offer some advice and guidance to the Oregon Health Authority as it seeks to enforce the law. The provisions around mandatory overtime remain related only to mandatory overtime. And the most significant change coming to you in the enforcement section will be tying the audit process to the hospital licensing process, which happens every 3 years. Taken together, the Oregon Nurses Association believes that these changes will strengthen the law by improving the functionality of the committee, bolstering the enforcement, and adding the additional advisory board to bring more expertise to discussions around staffing. We very much thank the Hospital Association for their work on this with us over the past months, and we will urge your support. Thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, the Associate Vice President of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And on behalf of Oregon's 62 hospitals, we thank the chair for the instructions to work with the Oregon Nurses Association to develop the contents of the proposed amendments in Senate Bill 469. We have, as Sarah mentioned, worked very closely over the last 6 weeks with both the association and our nurse leaders from our respected members. They've had two face-to-face meetings for which we were able to discuss some of these issues in full detail and length and to develop some solutions. The key provisions within the amendment for hospitals that were important to us to preserve were keeping a balance within the committee, keeping the 50% of the direct care providers and 50% the nurse leaders, as well as predictability and timeliness around audits and in the complaints investigation. Overall, we believe the modifications add clarity to the existing statute. And with that, I think we're here to answer any questions.
Seeing none, I'm hoping the amendments will come out. I hope Legislative Council is listening in case he printed something that you didn't say today, but thank you very much, and we will carry it over till Wednesday. If we don't have, if you don't have time, we'll carry it over to the very last day, which is next Monday. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 469 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 928. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 928 directs the Oregon Health Authority to operate a 24-hour toll-free telephone hotline to obtain health care advice from registered nurses, permits the nurses to have support necessary to conduct telephone triage and provide follow-up and assistance on referring callers for emergency care, making appointments to see a safety net provider, advising the caller on home care, and linking the caller to social service agencies. There's no amendment. There's no revenue impact, and fiscal statements haven't been issued.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jackie Winters, State Senator, Senate District 10, and I bring you this afternoon Senate Bill 928, which is a 24-hour advice hotline for Oregon residents. Madam Chair, the idea for this actually came from New Mexico. New Mexico had implemented a 24-hour hotline, which serves, which is interesting because we have a hotline for 211 and 911 and the 24-hour nurses advice hotline for Oregon residents would create a system with easy access for those who wish to seek reliable medical advice without having to go to the trouble or expense of a doctor's visit, particularly those crises, those things that occur during the evening. This is a preventive care bill that will connect patient and medical advice in the most convenient way possible, will prevent emergency room visits. When someone has a health concern outside of regular office hours, many are inclined to visit the nursing room because the middle of the night there is no other available medical care. The experience in New Mexico, interesting, has served 15,000 individuals per month. On the average, 15% of their callers are uninsured, and also sustained an overall caller satisfaction rate of 98%. Since they implemented the program. To date, over 1 million New Mexicans have accessed the hotline for services, which I find it really interesting when we start talking about utilization and whether or not it would prove to be of value, and I think that it would for our Argonians and as well. Another aspect to consider is the cost savings. New Mexico's model have saved $40.96 per triage encounter or phone call filled by the nurse's advice system, and this translated into over $3.5 million in savings per year to New Mexico's healthcare system. Also, the hotline there actually served to alleviate the volume in the emergency rooms due to crisis. So when I read all this and my staff researched this, I thought it would be applicable for us to actually copy New Mexico and adopt their system. This does not take away, by the way, you know, the question is, what would its impact be when we have our own reform? And I think it will only enhance what we've currently put in place through our CCOs. And so I hope that you will give positive consideration to actually passing in a work session on Senate Bill 928. And I notice that most of you are sponsors on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Winters. It's interesting, you're the only one that signed up for this. It would have been nice to have the Oregon Health Authority here. It is an expense. I don't know if we have a hotline for our patients in the CCO system. I don't know.
Currently, yeah. We do not.
Yes. Do you want to say anything, Rosa? You got to put it on the record. I don't have anything to say.
Hi, Rosa Klein, Oregon Health Authority. Senator Mona Sanderson, I haven't prepared any particular response, but I'm happy to get back with my people and send something to Zena for the committee to review.
Okay. I know that Providence has a nurse hotline, and I know Kaiser has a hotline. But it would be interesting to see if the CCOs would find this of value, and I don't know. Of course, it would be probably used by everyone.
And also, you know, looking at this, you know, it's I think that it's really good for our rural areas. I mean, let's be very practical and honest about the issues that occur in our rural communities as far as distance and travel and the actual availability in a crisis situation for getting advice and assistance as it relates to health care. So there's some other, you know, the metropolitan areas may have access to Providence and some of the others, but not all of our state, all parts of our states have those kind of resource availabilities. And so this can add just another valuable, I think, piece to.
And I do know that it would have probably a substantial fiscal, because we would need 24-hour. And so let me talk offline to OHA and to the senator, but to be able to call up and have something very simple, like when you have a baby with a diaper rash and you don't really need to go in and you wanted to know how to treat it. I mean, there are a number of things, so we'll talk offline.
Great.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 928 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 524. Zena?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 524 requires healthcare facilities to have written policies on life-sustaining procedures that are not likely to benefit a patient's or resident's medical condition. It requires the facility to provide a written policy within 12 hours of admission to the patient, resident, or legal guardian of minor. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement hasn't been issued.
And again, a bill that has no one signed up, but Senator Knope said that he would be very willing, since it's his bill, to tell us why we need this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Canope, representing Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. Colleagues, today I bring you Senate Bill 524. And this bill comes out of a constituent request. And what you're being handed is actually an article that was done on this family and another family who've had an issue come up. And so I just want to kind of describe this issue to you. The family is Rex and Don Allison. They're friends of ours. We go to the same church. I've known the family for a long time. I've known their kids. And I've known Abigail, who is the girl who had the situation. So when doctors diagnosed Abigail Allison with Wolf-Hirschhorn syndrome in 2004, they said she would live, that she wouldn't live beyond 2 years. They told parents, Rex and Don, to take Abigail home with hospice care. Wolf-Hirschhorn syndrome, caused by deleted genetic material associated with the fourth chromosome, affects 1 in 50,000 infants and causes delayed growth and intellectual development, as well as seizures. One-third of those who have it die within the first 2 years after birth, depending on the severity of the disorder. But Rex, a school psychologist, and Don, a physician, wanted to do more than hospice care with their daughter. The trouble was they had a hard time finding doctors who agreed. They often had to fight against the medical community to get the care that they thought their daughter deserved. When Abigail suffered a seizure at 11 months old, the emergency room doctor delayed treating her, eventually informing her father that he wasn't obligated to provide medical care. Another doctor told the Allisons he wouldn't spend health care dollars on Abigail for a blood test. When the Allisons took Abigail to the hospital again for a virus 3 years later, the doctor treating her said he wouldn't resuscitate her if she stopped breathing. Doctors placed a do not resuscitate order on Abigail's chart without her parents' knowledge. It was my understanding that you had to have written consent if you're going to put a DNR on their chart, Don Allison said. I never imagined this would happen in the United States. The doctor removed the DNR from Abigail's chart at her father's request. But Rex Allison believes the doctor agreed only because the couple's medical knowledge and understanding of Abigail's disability. The actual incident that is entailed there is much more intricate. And in fact, the Allisons were told that the hospital wouldn't spend a dime on her because she was going to die anyway. She's now 11 years old. This happened several years ago. But if it wasn't for the Allisons' medical knowledge, they would not have been able to save her life, because that hospital did not want to transfer her. And all that she really needed was IV. And she needed water because she was dehydrating. She was going to die. And through a verbal jousting with the hospital, ultimately that hospital released her to go to another hospital in the Portland metro area. And she got the care she needed to save her life. So really what we're trying to accomplish is just that if you have these policies in place as a hospital, that you inform the parents of the minor child that, in fact, that's the policies that you have, so they can deal with it from that perspective, as opposed to not knowing and having to guess, are we going to get treatment? Are we not going to get treatment? Are we going to get the truth? Are we going to get a version of the truth? And so I don't think this happens very often, but I do think it does happen. And I think the bill that we proposed is a potential solution to that problem. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I agree with you. The problem is because we probably have to have a conversation with the carriers, OHA, and the hospitals. And I really would like during interim for us to talk about this. From their perspective, I don't like bills going out that may have ramifications outside of specifically what you're asking. Would you be amenable to a work group with OHA, the hospitals? I think Rosa's listening. I think Andy and Patty O'Sullivan, are they in the room? No.
Madam Chair, if you pass the bill, I'm confident the discussion will get started.
and the carriers.
That's why we have February sessions, right?
Apparently.
Yes. So that's what I'd like to do with the bill, Senator Knope.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 524 and open a public hearing on 695. Oh, we're supposed to text Bates. Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, Ms. O'Sullivan is there. No, it's okay.
Oh, no, I'll talk to you later. Okay.
She's still the work group.
Senate Bill 695 repeals the sunset on authority of Oregon Health Authority to contract with prepaid managed care health service organizations to provide care to medical assistance recipients. It modifies the definition of prepaid managed care health service organizations to manage dental care, managed health, or chemical dependency organization that contracts with OHA coordinated care or coordinated care organizations. There's a dash one amendment that directs the Oregon Health Authority to study effectiveness of dental organizations in providing dental care and integration of dental care organizations into coordinated care organizations. It requires the contract with private entity to conduct the study and requires OHA to report the effects of the interim committee of the Legislative Assembly, and it appropriates funding for the biennium. There's no revenue impact and a fiscal statement has been issued.
I will talk really slow while Bates gets here. Evidently, the House has a bill also that's almost a mirror image of this one. They are sending it down to Ways and Means, and Senator Bates would like this to go to Ways and Means also. It will have a fiscal, correct? Do we have a fiscal this time? Right now, the way it is now, we have a fiscal light, so we could.
Sorry.
Oh no, we don't. $150,000 on That's the dash like one amendment, so we don't need any other amendment. And Bates is still not here. So Deborah Loy and Dr. Shercliffe. Okay, please come forward, and then as soon as Bates walks in, let him take charge.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn, representing Advantage Dental. I'll be a place filler until Senator Bates gets here. One of the things that Senate Bill 695 does is address a concern that a number of OHP patients are not enrolled in a CCO. They may be Native Americans, non-documented, for various reasons they're not enrolled. And under current law in 2017, the DCOs...
Here he is, so do you want to stop?
Yes.
The
DCOs would cease to function, and this just recognizes that need to continue functioning on a small scale.
For fee for service. No, stay there. Just scoot over.
Madam Chair, for the record, Alan Bates, District 3, Senate. I don't know what these people are lying to you about, but I'll tell you the truth now, okay? Senate Bill 695 is a bill obviously primarily about dental care organizations. Let me give a little background if I could, please. We have a dental care system in this state that, from the point of view of the panels we have, is fairly fragile. Most dentists don't take Medicaid patients. Their pay is low. The need is very high, a lot of pent-up demand. And the dentists that do it, we really appreciate them doing it. They usually do it as a small part of their practice. We have a multitude of plans. They are well managed by the dental care organizations. They have software that runs them and do the billing, and the dentists have confidence in these plans. When we started setting up CCOs, we ultimately wanted to have the dentist inside CCOs, either through the plans or directly. Primarily, we thought about doing it directly. One of the things we didn't realize, and this is an outlier for dental care organizations compared to mental health organizations and physical health organizations, they don't match up geographically. Most of your CCOs are in a community or in a geographical area, and all the providers live and work in that area. DCOs are scattered across the state. So as an example, one CCO may have four or five DCOs they work with. Some may have more, some may have less. That means they have to contract with each one of these. So our first hurdle a couple of years ago was to get all the DCOs and the CCOs to have contracts to work with. That was really difficult. We got there. Everyone's contracted now. They're in their first year of those contracts. Ultimately, I think there's going to be some migration of lives and panels, and things will be working out pretty well. Forcing the DCOs to end in 17 is something that just can't be done administratively. We need more time for them to sort themselves geographically, make sure we don't destroy our panels and hurt patients who need dental care. That's basically what this bill does. There's another piece to it. We have about 50,000 lives who can't go into CCOs. These are Pacific Islanders and some Native American tribes and some others that would have to be handled separately.
Meaning they have to be fee-for-service?
They have to be fee-for-service. And that means DCOs have to somehow maintain a relationship with the state that they can do that. If they don't, they're going to have to go to DCBS and be re-licensed, and this whole thing could fall apart. And we need to handle this very, very carefully. So what we would like to do with this is get a good look at it, do a little bit of a study on it, and bring it down to Ways and Means so we can continue to work on it and make sure it's right where we want it to be. There's a companion bill coming from the House that's not quite the same that's already been sent down to Ways and Means. We want this one down there, too. And so I'm asking you to put the Dash 1 amendments in, which is the study. So if we need to do the study, we can. I expect quite likely that we won't. But I'd like to have you bring the Dash 1s into the bill and bring it down to Ways and Means so we can continue to work on this and make sure we've got it just right.
Thank you very much. Deborah?
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care, a dental care organization with the Oregon Health Plan. We have about 300,000 lives, and we are a dental care organization that is affected by this bill, so we are supporting it. We thank Senator Bates for introducing it. In my understanding of the bill, there were some unintended consequences with the transformation legislation, House Bill 3650 and 1580, and one of them was on July 1st, 2017, prepaid managed care plans are eliminated. This eliminated a legal status that allowed plans like ours, which only do Medicaid, basically, I don't have to be an insurance company because I was a prepaid health plan just contracting with the Oregon Health Plan for services. So if you eliminate that status, I would no longer be able to do all the things that look like an insurance company, like hold reserves, pay claims, take on risks, those kinds of things without potentially having to come under DCBS, if I got the acronym right. By removing the sunset allows me to continue in that legal status. Also, most of my membership on July 1st, 2014, when I was integrated with all my 14 CCOs, are now in a subcontractor status. So it also allows me, whether I'm a direct contractor with the state and or a subcontractor to a coordinated care organization, to not need to be an insurance company to do that. And as Senator Bates has spoken to and Jim Bunn, there is a specific called out legal group of folks that can choose to be outside a CCO, but may elect and have elected to choose a dental plan because they otherwise, as an open card dental person, they have no access at all. So even though they've exercised their options to be outside of a CCO, they've elected to be in a dental care organization. I think there's roughly about 50,000 of those folks. And again, they're very legally descriptive. It is the, I think, third trimester pregnancy. They're in a commercial insurance company, but we take those in dental plans or the Indians, some of the Native Americans and stuff. So it is a specific group, and it allows me to continue to be a direct contractor with the state for those folks.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 695 and open a work session on Senate Bill 695.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment in the Senate Bill 695.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 695. Is there any discussion? there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 695 as amended by the Dash 1 Amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 695 as amended with the Dash 1 Amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
I got in for you, Alan. So.
Clerk will call the roll.
You beat me in this motion.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 695, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 663.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 663 alters the framework for conducting public health activities and providing services. There's a Dash 2 amendment which replaces the measure. It requires on premises where people make retail sales of tobacco products and inhalant delivery systems to be licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Permits sampling of inhalant delivery systems at premises and businesses have 75% of revenue from inhalant delivery systems. When no tobacco or alcohol is sold and no one under 18 may enter, it establishes the Tobacco Control Fund. Permits aerosolizing or vaporizing without cannabinoids on premises within certain criteria. Fiscal and revenue statements have not been issued.
Okay.
Go on this one.
Okay.
So do you want to speak to the Dash? We're only speaking to the Dash
twos.
Twos, yes. Right now. And so Senator Steiner Hayward.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Senate District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton, and also family physician. The Dash 2 amendments that you see in front of you are targeted to decrease use of tobacco by minors and also inhalant delivery system by minors. We have also considered other bills that would limit the use of inhaled delivery systems, but this goes the next step. To include them in the licensure provision. Oregon is one of only 8 states in the union that does not license tobacco retailers. That is to say that as long as taxes are paid accurately, there's no way to tell who's selling cigarettes. And those taxes are paid at the wholesale level, not the retail level. So to sell alcohol, you have to have a license. To sell marijuana, you will have to have a license. To sell tobacco, you do not have to have a license. And it's one of the reasons that Oregon has one of the highest rates of sales to minors in the nation, which is very problematic from my perspective. We know also that keeping kids from starting to smoke is the best way to keep them from smoking ever. The later people sample tobacco or nicotine, the less likely they are to become addicted to it. The biggest issues in this bill are simply that tobacco retail licensure and inhaled delivery system retail licensure would fall under the purview of OLCC. That would not start until 2017. OLCC is rather busy right now with marijuana implementation, so they requested a little bit of a stay on this, which seems reasonable to me. The Dash 2s do have one provision in there that we would actually ultimately hope to change. I think they still have that one in there, which is to prohibit sales of tobacco in places that also have pharmacies. We plan to take that one out. We think that at this point that's probably going a step too far. It does, however, have provisions to prohibit sales within 1,000 feet of schools, but with a grandfather clause, provisions that require licenses to be associated with a fixed physical address to prevent mobile sales, and others like that. We will also be, Madam Chair, adding another amendment should this bill move forward that would make it clear that OLCC should not, if a retailer is licensed to sell both tobacco and alcohol, violations of one should not impinge on the retailer to sell the other. So that is to say, if a retailer that sells beer and tobacco is found to be guilty, have sold tobacco to a minor, that should not interfere with their liquor license, and I think that's completely reasonable. Currently, really, the only enforcement that we have available to us if retailers sell tobacco to minors is a fine that currently only stands at $500, and that's to the person who sells it. So the clerk
probably somebody working part-time to help pay for school or put bread on the table is the one who pays that $500 fine. The manager of the store has no responsibility. That is not true for liquor sales. It will not be true likely for marijuana sales either. Tobacco is at least as addictive as either of these two substances and ultimately causes millions of dollars of death and premature millions of dollars of health care and premature life, years of premature life lost. And so that's why we want to move this. We would also, with this bill, allow the sampling of liquids used in inhaled delivery systems in the so-called vape shops. We think that's a reasonable thing for them to do under the circumstances, and that would allow them to use their products, as they've testified before us previously, to help people stop smoking, which is a laudable goal, in my opinion. Although I remain concerned about some of the things in electronics than those liquids, I still think that they're less worse than inhaling or chewing tobacco. So this is part of a coordinated effort to reduce tobacco use by minors in this state and to make sure that we have the ability to enforce laws around tobacco retail sales. I'm sure that others can offer more testimony. I believe the health authority is here, and I would like, if possible, to have them testify. Madam Chair, and the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association have submitted written testimony, which I hope is up in OLIS by now, but if not, will be soon. they will not specifically be testifying. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, however, would like to testify as well, and then I'm sure we have lots of other public testimony. But I'm happy to take questions now or after others come.
Just to put on the record again, the Dash 2s will not be passing out of this committee.
No.
So there'll be another amendment coming forward. It's going to grandfather those within 1,000 feet of a school. It's going to remove the pharmacy prohibition
right
on pharmacies retail.
Right, so they could still sell tobacco in big box stores, in retailers such as Fred Meyer or whatever that have pharmacies.
And those are the only two changes?
There's also going to be language to say that OLCC should not use violations of tobacco retail sales as relevant to somebody's liquor license, license to sell beer or wine or other distilled spirits, and that there's something I'm forgetting.
You can mention it when you're up here.
I'll mention it again when I remember it.
Okay, so, with that,
I think Sarah Cruz has a.
Okay.
A major concern based on their performance in the marijuana committee, I think OLCC is one of the most inept organizations in the state, and I'm not sure tasking them with another job is the appropriate thing. You might want to consider another home.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Cruz, I appreciate your concerns. I'm not going to comment on the competence of OLCC or lack thereof because I have not been participating in that committee. I'm sorry that that's your perception. I think that they've done a reasonable job licensing liquor over the past several years. We haven't had significant concerns about selling to minors in this state. And one of the points that I would make is that there is a delay in implementation of this, which would allow OLCC to continue to improve its operations as it takes on the functions of licensing marijuana and enforcement of that. That's a subject for the conversation as well.
Okay. Thank you. Jennifer Vines, Mafisa Fay, and Tia Henderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Jennifer Vines. I'm the Deputy Health Officer for Multnomah County Health Department. I'm a family physician, and I'm also board certified in public health and preventive medicine. Thank you for the chance to talk to you today about this really incredibly important piece of public health legislation. This really allows Oregon communities to support parents, to level the playing field for businesses, and to enforce our tobacco laws. I'll start by reminding you that the vast majority of smokers begin before age 18, and as you know, our Board of Commissioners commissioners in Multnomah County has taken a keen interest in the topic of youth access both to tobacco and to nicotine. We have banned the sale of electronic cigarettes to minors in our county. We've included electronic cigarettes in our smoke-free workplace ordinance, and our commissioners have signaled their interest in moving forward on tobacco retailing if the state does not. So please consider us a strong and supportive partners in this endeavor. The retail licensing is not just a question of youth protection. In Multnomah County, the SINAR enforcement program in 2014 revealed that one in four Multnomah County retailers readily sold to minor decoys. And such a high noncompliance rate puts the entire state at risk of losing millions of dollars from the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. So please keep that in mind. I'd also urge you to revisit the question of exempting of vape shops for the Indoor Clean Air Act. I think there is a growing body of evidence that secondhand vapor is not just water vapor, contains dangerous chemicals, it can be passively vaped. At best, such an exemption creates confusion and difficulties in enforcing our indoor tobacco laws, and at worst, it exposes vape shop employees and tenants of the same building with shared airspace to the unknown potential harms of secondhand vapor. The bill also, as it currently reads, does not subject vape shops to the same requirements as smoke shops. So smoke shops must be standalone with no shared ventilation. And we have actually seen complaints around shared ventilation with vape shops in our county. So I'd bring that to your attention. It also looks like in the current writing that vape shops would only be examined by the OLCC if there is a complaint. So again, I think maybe revisiting some of that language to strengthen that language and make vape shops more like smoke shops may be of benefit, again, in the public health interest. Thank you for your time and attention today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Tia Henderson. I'm the research manager at Upstream Public Health. And on behalf of our organization, we recommend passing this policy to protect the next generation of children as far from accessing tobacco and addictive nicotine products. As my colleague, Dr. Vines, already mentioned, 9 out of 10 users start before the age of 18, and really we want to get ahead of burdening another generation from an addictive substance. We also have a few suggestions for language changes. My executive director has already submitted those, and we can talk about them later. But primarily, we want to increase clarity in the bill about who pays penalties. Right now, it doesn't kind of support an owner of a retail establishment being accountable and setting up their own business policy, making sure that everyone on staff is equally trained. We also have a request for enforcement and training be part of this policy, and making sure that retailers for whom English is not their first language have different type of training methods so that different policies like this one or alcohol are very clear. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Nafisa Fai. I work for Upstream Public Health as well. And I echo what Tia and Dr. Vines both said. This is a good idea. This is what Oregon needs. We have the data to prove that our youth are not being protected from these harmful products. So I urge you to pass this bill and consider some of the amendments that we suggested both electronically and verbally here.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for testifying, Michael Tynan.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Michael Tynan. I'm the policy director for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority, and previously I worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on this issue. Oregon's Tobacco Prevention Education Program is an evidence-based program that's effective. Since 1997, cigarette consumption in Oregon has been reduced by about 50%. But despite declines in tobacco use, we know that tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death and disease in Oregon and in this country. Tobacco is responsible for 7,000 deaths in Oregon each year. And addiction to nicotine starts in adolescence. 9 out of 10 adults who smoke started before the age of 18. Last year, 3,300 kids in Oregon started smoking. That's more than graduated from all of the public high schools in Medford, Bend, and Pendleton combined. Advertising tobacco retail practices is one important evidence-based strategy. I'm sorry, addressing tobacco retail practices is one important evidence-based strategy that the state can work on to prevent youth from using tobacco and helping current users quit. We know there's a causal relationship between price and marketing, and this term causal relationship is important. The Surgeon General in 2012 wrote a report about youth smoking and found that advertising and promotional activities by tobacco companies have been shown to cause the onset and continuation of smoking. This is a causal relationship. This is a scientific term that the Surgeon General uses that is the strongest link of evidence. Since the inception of TPEP, the tobacco program, in 1997, smoking rates for 11th graders have declined by 80%. So that smoking rates today among our youth are less than 10%. But youth use of other tobacco products, e-cigarettes, large and small cigars, hookah, snuff, dip, and chew, are on the rise. About 18% of 11th graders use those products. Higher levels of tobacco marketing at the retail space, lower tobacco prices, and greater availability of tobacco coupons and promotions are associated with product uptake among middle and high school students. Tobacco products are cheap, they're readily available, and they're easy for kids to quit. It's been illegal to sell tobacco products to youth for a long time in this state. Yet, as you'll hear, as you've already heard today, and I'll say it a little bit later, 21% of tobacco retailers are illegally selling tobacco products to kids. The tobacco industry has shifted their marketing from billboards and television commercials in the 70s to convenience stores, pharmacies, and grocery stores today. In fact, the tobacco industry is spending $112 million to advertise and promote their products to Oregon's kids. Tobacco products can be displayed at young kids' eye levels, 3 feet or lower, and we have data that shows that they're doing this. And it can be displayed right near the candy, and we have data that shows that they're doing this. The tobacco industry's strategy has been to market to kids in Oregon stores is working. 7 out of 10 11th graders recall seeing an advertisement for tobacco products on a storefront or inside of a store. That's why addressing the retail environment is proven to reduce tobacco use. The use of coupons, for example, makes cigarettes more affordable. Again, the Surgeon General in 2012 found that the industry's exclusive use of price-reducing promotions has led to higher rates of tobacco use among young people. Evidence shows that coupons also encourage new smokers to smoke more often, thereby entrenching their addiction. Also, where tobacco and nicotine retailers are located affect whether or not youth smoke. Youth who live or go to school in neighborhoods where there are more tobacco retailers or more tobacco outlets have higher smoking rates compared to youth in neighborhoods with fewer tobacco outlets. These kids are more likely to experiment with smoking, they're more likely to start smoking, and they're more likely to remain smokers. We have data on what this looks like in Oregon. Our tobacco programs in the counties conducted over 1,200 assessments throughout the state. They found that the average price of tobacco products ranged from $1.04 for a single flavored little cigar to about $5 a pack for a pack of traditional cigarettes. Three quarters of tobacco retailers had price discounts for at least one type of tobacco products. And even when excluding menthol and cigarettes, more than 93% of tobacco retailers sold one type of flavored products. 25% displayed tobacco products within 12 inches of products like toys, candy, gum, slushy, or soda machines. And nearly 24% of tobacco retailers advertised within 3 feet of the floor at eye level of our smallest children. Currently, Oregon is one of 8 states that do not require tobacco retailers to hold a license. Senate Bill 663 would require a tobacco retail license and include multiple provisions that are proven to prevent youth tobacco initiation in youth. These restrictions include not allowing tobacco retailers to accept coupons, not allowing stores to be located within 1,000 feet of a school, and they could not offer free sampling of tobacco products. These components of a license are evidence-based, have been tested in other communities across the country, and would reduce youth exposure to tobacco and nicotine products. Retail licensure also creates a straightforward method for identifying businesses that sell tobacco products. The sale of tobacco products is already illegal in Oregon to kill children under the age of 18. However, 17% of our 11th graders report to us that they're getting their tobacco products from a gas station or a store. Furthermore, as I said earlier, 21% of tobacco retailers in Oregon are illegally selling to minors based on information from the SINAR program. This bill would greatly help enforce youth access laws. Laws that prohibit sales to minors are important, but alone will not keep kids from using tobacco or nicotine products. We know that to prevent youth initiation of tobacco, we must take a comprehensive approach like Senate Bill S-663 does. This bill sets in motion evidence-based tobacco retail policies that will reduce the number of children and young adults who become addicted to nicotine. The Public Health Division appreciates this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Yes. I have a question, Michael. You said that there were... We are one of 8 states that does not license tobacco products. Does that mean all the others do license?
Yeah, so there's 8 states that do not license cigarettes, and then if you count there's 9 states that don't license cigarettes. There's 1 state that does license other tobacco products. So if you look at any type of tobacco products, there's 8 states that don't have any kind of license. The other states do. So states like Kentucky, where I'm from, for example, a state with a very high smoking rate, it does require a tobacco license.
Then, and then what about now with e-cigarettes coming and being so common? What about licensing that in other states?
That's a little less uncommon. I don't know what those numbers are off the top of my head because they're a relatively new product. There are license provisions in Minnesota and North Carolina off the top of my head. I'm sure there are more, but those are the two
Minnesota
states.
Minnesota and
North Carolina are the two that I can think of.
That do license e-cigarettes. Okay, so it's not an uncommon
thing. It's been done. But, I mean, you know, e-cigarettes are relatively new to the market
as
well.
Yes, I know that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you. All right. I want Kelly Lovelace and then, Will Krause and Ron Sather. And let's have Kelly Lovelace go first.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Kelly Lovelace. I live in Lane County. I am not in favor of this bill. And let me give you a little history. I'm somebody who started smoking when I was 16, which was probably close to 50 years ago. E-cigarettes interested me in vaping because I saw an avenue that I could get off of cigarettes with. A friend of mine was a therapist for people that have COPD and those kind of lung ailments was also a smoker. And she got involved in vaping and quit. And her take on what's going on here in vaping is you're basically using pretty much the same elements in vaping to get the vape that you would get in a nebulizer that a doctor might prescribe to a child with asthma or something. Now, granted, there's other medications in it, but it is my understanding that that's pretty close to the truth. And so I wonder where we're going with trying to put vaping products under tobacco. It's not a tobacco product. It has nicotine in it for people that are trying to quit smoking. But it is not a tobacco product in any sense of the word. And so to classify it that is not exactly being honest by anybody because it's not a tobacco product. The other thing that, you know, we're here and we're listening to a lot of testimony about the youth and we don't want them to get involved in smoking. I agree. I do not want kids to start smoking. But I also am a realist. And I've tried to think of something to compare this to, and I think birth control and kids is where I go. There isn't anybody sitting up there that wants children involved in those kind of activities, but yet we've managed to pass laws that allow them to almost anywhere get birth control. Now, it's not because we're condoning that particular activity. We're trying to mitigate some of the actions that come from that. I truly believe that when we have people vaping, I don't want kids in the shop buying from us, but I also know I would much sooner them think about vaping than think about smoking cigarettes. Now, I'm not saying we want it legal for them, but I live in a world that is real. I know that you're not going to legislate anything that is going to stop every kid from smoking, just like you're not going to legislate anything that's going to stop them from having sex, okay? It's not going to happen. You may want it, but it isn't going to happen. And then the other thing, there's this right here, political analysis, state budget solutions. According to what I've read, and I've read a lot now, this vaping industry could drastically reduce smokers and also end up saving states a tremendous amount of money on Medicaid money simply because it's going to eliminate over time a lot of costs that smoking would cause. So I think there's a lot of issues here that we're jumping in the middle of before we really have an understanding of the cost of what's going on or what we ought to be doing. And sometimes it pays to wait a few minutes and figure out where we're going. And I'm saying maybe not minutes, but a few years and really figure out where this is heading and what it may do or may not do for the state of Oregon and other states. So I think vaping is probably something you ought to put on a back burner and let some of this fall out a little farther. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Ronald Sather. I'm a voter from Senate District 8 in Albany. I am also an owner of a vape shop and a board member of the Northwest Vapor Association, NUVA. I oppose Senate Bill 663-2 as written, just as I opposed 417-6, which is where this bill actually came from. NUVA, nor any stakeholder from the vaping industry that I'm aware of, was ever consulted in any of these work sessions that were creating these bills. The vape industry is a major stakeholder here and has no say whatsoever in the formulating of this legislation. I don't believe that's right. NUVA consists of Oregon shop owners and manufacturers that are the regional experts in the vaping industry. NUVA has insights from an industry standpoint that could help accomplish the goals and intent of this bill. We could be very instrumental in foreseeing some of the unintended consequences that this legislation is likely to produce as well. We are already actually in working with the Department of Justice and the Department of Revenue on some very similar negotiations, trying to figure out how to get some of the same exact issues that we're dealing with here. I think passing this bill as written could derail some of those talks. We've offered to work together to revise this bill to no avail. NUVA is not against regulations in the vaping industry. However, we want reasonable regulation and some fair representation in this. So far, I don't see that we've gotten either. With this bill not becoming effective until 2017, we'd ask that you either set this bill aside and invite us to the table, or take inhalant delivery systems completely out of the bill and move forward with the tobacco portion. Just as we offered before the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation last week, NUVA would still embrace the opportunity to become part of this discussion. This bill could still be reintroduced next year as a solid piece of legislation that represents good, sound public policy while still meeting the goals and intent of this bill in a very timely fashion. I think we could come through on a consensus by then and have this rush right through. I've also heard countless times throughout this year, throughout the course of these hearings, that Oregon has the highest rate in the nation of tobacco sales to minors. Yet according to the FDA, who performed over 1,000 things in Oregon last year, we ranked very well. In fact, Oregon is over 94% in compliance, according to their statistics. Statistics also show that Oregon has one of the lowest teen smoking rates in the nation. I think we're like number fourth in the nation statewise as far as teen smokers go. These numbers suggest that the current system is not only working, but working quite well, especially considering that Oregon only spends about 25% of CDC recommendations on tobacco awareness and prevention. I think they spent $9.9 million last year. CDC recommend $39.2 million. So I think we're doing quite well in that regards. I really think we could have helped avoid some of the unintended consequences that this bill, which you're already finding out that there is unintended consequences, as evidenced by the Dash 3 amendment. Most of what that's covering we could have easily pointed out ahead of time if we had been invited to any of these work groups.
Well, I do know that there's been talk with Matt Minahan, and I think he's your lobbyist, and that's rather than talking probably with individual vapors, we've been discussing things with Matt Minahan, who is your representative.
Yes, I agree. Recently you have been, but this legislation was already written, most of it at that point.
Okay. Next.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, my name is Will Krause, and I am president of the Northwest Vapor Association. I also own a business that manufactures and sells e-cigarettes and e-cigarette products. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you here today, and I have a presentation here I'd like to go through. I'll go through it as quickly as possible.
Yes, because we will reach a point where I'm going to have to limit everyone to 3 minutes.
I understand that. Northwest Vapor Association is an association of e-cigarette manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and users committed to protecting the rights of the e-cigarette or vaping industry. We are made up of businesses licensed by the state of Oregon to do business in this state. We provide jobs for Oregon residents, and we are committed to providing a safer and healthier alternative to smoking cigarettes. Our primary audience is people who smoke cigarettes today. We do not go after young people who aren't yet smoking or even adults who are not yet smoking. We're not against regulations on our industry. In fact, we believe that proper and reasonable regulations are necessary to protect the health and safety of Oregon residents and the e-cigarette industry. We specifically want to eliminate the unsafe garage and basement-based black market businesses that are harmful to our industry and Oregon residents. That's a little bit about who we are. We do oppose Bill 663 as rewritten in the Dash 2 amendment, because e-cigarettes or vaping products are not tobacco products. And this bill, along with a number of others that have been introduced this session, lump us together with tobacco products. Yes, e-cigarettes, vaping products contain nicotine. Some of them do, not all of them do. But that doesn't make us a tobacco product. In fact, there are many plants like the tomato plant, the potato plant, the eggplant, and even the petunia contain nicotine. And in fact, you can absorb more nicotine by touching the leaf of one of those plants than you will get from being in the room with somebody exhaling vapor from an e-cigarette. And that's been proven by studies. Another reason we oppose this is that industry events with vaping permitted are an important part of our industry, and this bill would outlaw them. Between this bill and HB 2546, all of our businesses are under the authority of two different regulating bodies, both the OLCC and the OHA. This will provide plenty of confusion and consternation, not only for us, but for those regulating bodies. Also, the grandfather provision of this bill in terms of an exemption for vaping is too easily rescinded at the whim of the OLCC. The language in this bill is unnecessarily vague and in too many places. The cost of the permitting is undefined and can be established or changed at the whim of OLCC. And as Ron has already mentioned, there's been no consultation with a true representative of the e-cigarette industry in the crafting of this and other proposed bills. That doesn't mean we don't like anything about this bill. There are some things that we do like about it. It attempts to eliminate or at least control the growing black market of sales of potentially unsafe e-cigarette products. That is, those that are not in conformance with established vaping industry manufacturing standards, such as those defined by the American Electronic Cigarette Manufacturers Standards Association. Most of our shops that produce e-liquid already conform to this industry standard. This bill allows for an exclusion of vape shops from the Clean Air Act for the purpose of sampling products and repair products. We like that. We also like the fact that this bill won't take effect until July of 2017. Now, what our proposal is this. Since the bill as amended doesn't take effect until July 2017, we propose that this bill be tabled for the current session and that you allow NUVA to be an active partner with the Oregon legislature to draft a new bill for the 2016 legislative session. And in doing so, we will provide industry support for the new legislation to take effect in 2017. We would actually then become a bellwether state in implementing reasonable and effective legislation for the e-cigarette vaping industry that is mutually developed, mutually beneficial, and mutually supported by the legislature and the e-cigarette industry. In summary, we cannot support Senate Bill 663 as rewritten in the Dash 2 amendment, but we are keenly interested in working with the legislature to craft reasonable and effective legislation for the 2016 legislative session to take effect in 2017. Thank you for your time and giving me this opportunity.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Are you prepared to trade to not have sampling in your stores while we wait for sorting out the licensure issue?
That is something that I certainly would be willing to take to our membership and get a reading on. And if our membership is willing to do that, then I certainly would support it.
Okay, we can have a conversation further.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Matt Minahan and Jesse Sweet. And James Wright.
Senator Montes Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent the Northwest Vapor Association. I'm here to clear up kind of a little about the workings on this bill. I think what we're talking about as an association is not being included is the original when 2546, the committee was formed, number of input was put in on that bill. We were an association at that time. So not quite fair to say we weren't included. We didn't have any representation from any of the members or any of the vape shop community. But again, we weren't an association at that time. You guys have seen me many times, worked with me a number of times on this bill, and no, we have not come to a consensus. We disagree with this bill in many forms. Yes, we do think it could be better. We have been working with you and a number of associations to try to get there. We're not quite there. I do want to acknowledge the work you have done on the flavors, how far you have come on the flavors and the understanding about how we're using flavors to market to adults and how adults are using these flavors. I also want to acknowledge that you have worked very hard to understand our exclusion and why we're after the vape shop exclusion from the Clean Air Act. It's not a sit around and hold hands and vape and it is a very essential part of getting people off of smoking, finding the right sensation, the right level of nicotine, the right flavor, what's going to stop us from smoking. Fortunate we can't quite get there. The message is that we think we could make this bill better. We certainly come to the table, and we have come to the table, and we have been invited to the table to have those discussions on how to get there. So I do agree that we could, we have been working with the, and it's not the Oregon Department of Revenue, it's the Oregon Department of Justice, on the internet sales bill as far as how to not sell to minors. We've been coming up with some ideas on registration, and we actually have industry standards that the industry has come up with, such as clean room environments, not selling these out of a garage, having an actual location, child proofing. We're certainly for that type of regulation, and we'll continue to work with you on getting there. So again, we're opposed with this bill, but to say that you guys haven't been working with us is not entirely correct. We understand you guys have been invited. We're a little late to the table. Being an association, we're a new association and growing, and we just look forward to continue to work with you guys on, or the committee or anyone involved in crafting this legislation on how we can get there, not necessarily maybe through this bill, but how we can solve some of the same problems, and we do appreciate your work.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I am a policy analyst with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I will be brief. I'd like to state for the record that the commission has not taken a formal position on the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 663-2. However, I do believe that staff is capable to take on the additional responsibilities described in the bill. The Liquor Commission's experience in licensing off-premise sales outlets to sell alcoholic beverages and ensuring that these outlets do not sell to minors translates well to the regulation of tobacco retailers. In fact, approximately 85% of the tobacco retailers in Oregon currently hold a liquor license. Additionally, OLCC has valuable experience conducting minor decoy operations for sales to minors that would be applicable to sales to minors by tobacco retailers. Due to the significant undertaking in implementing Measure 91, OLCC staff is sensitive to the timing of implementation of this bill. Senator Steiner Hayward spoke to this issue in her testimony, and we believe that the July 2017 start date will give us ample time to take on the program if we are tasked to do so. I would note that we would not have any revenues coming in at that time, and we would seek authority from the legislature to borrow against the liquor fund as we have for marijuana implementation. Should the bill move forward, the OLCC intends to work proactively with this and future legislatures in planning for implementation and leveraging our existing regulatory structure towards this new task. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Yes. Madam Chair, I think this is for Matt. Matt, can you tell us how this bill or the Dash 25s of the other House Bill 2473, I think, interacts with Multnomah County's ordinance and the clean air aspects of it?
Yes. I was Chair Miles Anderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee. I was involved a little bit in the county discussions. My view on the county had their, it's not the Clean Air Act, it's their Smoke-Free Workplace Act, I believe. And what that says, anywhere you can't smoke, you can't vape. And they just passed that. I believe it came into effect on the 5th of April. Those discussions, I think, were a little premature because they based a lot of that on what the state was doing and that there was no, you know, regulation currently for the vaping industry. My point to them was, the state is working on that, and it was my my assumption that the state would have some sort of exclusion for vape shops once they understood the importance of vape shops. They went ahead and passed that ordinance without any exclusion. My hope would be that they would revisit that once the state does make a determination on that, and should we get an exclusion, mainly just so we don't have a patchwork of different laws around the industry. And you know, the main message to them and to the state too, and I think that the main contention on this bill is the vaping industry is not tobacco. And they just the fact of why they want kind of a separate bill and to work of these issues separately is very high emotions around these vape shop owners are anti-tobacco just as much as anybody else, because their goal is to get people to stop smoking. They've been smokers themselves, and they've stopped smoking and vaping. So anything that wraps them in with tobacco is, you know, very contentious for them. But again, to answer your question, should the state give us an exclusion for the vape shops, there would be a disconnect between what the counties have done, Multnomah County and the state of Oregon has done. I would hope to go back and revisit that with them and say, okay, now that the state has spoken and given this exclusion and seen the importance for the exclusion, that maybe we can come to some sort of agreement on the county level as well.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, the thing I was trying to remember that was going to come in the Dash 3s was a statewide preemption. So the Dash 3s would have a statewide preemption so that all the licensing would be identical across the state and the rules would be identical across the state.
Which would serve the same purpose of what you want the county to reach.
Yes, I don't know how that would go retroactively or you know what they've done, but again, once this session's over and the state has spoken on the matter, I'd be more than happy to sit down with county officials and have those discussions with them.
Thank you.
Senator Miles Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Wright. I am a lab manager for Vape Right, a vape store in Kaiser, Oregon. I will be very brief because everything that I pretty much had written down here has been covered about three times. So my only thing is as a vape shop owner, my intent is to have children buy vape products in my store. And I understand that's what, you know, these bills do. They protect children. I don't sell children. I never have. Since the day we've opened our doors, I've had 18 and older on my front door. I'm not going to go over everything with all the OLCC stuff and everything over and over again, because I'm sure you heard it all. So that's pretty much it. Being the last man standing.
All right. Well, I would like you to know that there is a vape shop right on the corner across the street from Gresham Union High School, which is in my district.
Right.
And so there will be 18-year-olds coming. And so the shop owner will really have to be very astute. But still, selling to an 18-year-old would be legal. And my worry is that then they would then sell to other students.
Senator Moss Anderson, members of the committee, if I may. Where my shop is located, I'm located close to McNary in Kaiser. McNary. And there's actually a private school that's behind me. So I am aware that, you know, the schools are around me. And that is also a concern of mine, whether, you know, they're going to take it and then they're going to sell it to their 16-year-old buddy. I had a customer call, and he was a child of 17, and he's like, well, if I send my buddy in, can he pick it up for me? He's over 18. I'm like, no, I'm not.
But we will have that problem no matter what.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to say, Senator Ron Sanderson, members of the committee, in these discussions that we want to have in a more comprehensive bill, we would be open to talking about maybe making a 21 and over. Our membership is not totally opposed to that. I would say we're even less than split on that. But if you wanted to have those discussions about 21 and over, we'd be more than happy to have those.
Thank you so much. All right. Any other questions? Okay. Joseph Gilpatrick, Tim Churchill, and Taylor Jones.
Chair Moss Anderson, senators, thank you very much for hearing me today. I just wanted to say right off the bat, you know, I've met with
your name.
Oh, Joseph Gilpatrick. I'm a vape shop owner as well. I'm not really here as a vape shop owner today. I'm here as a father. I think we do need regulation, not in the form of this bill. I believe that, you know, nicotine and tobacco are highly addictive, and we do need regulation. I don't believe that this bill is the way to go about doing so. I just wanted to say, like, again, thank you. You guys have been listening to us this year. A lot of these bills coming up, you've been really receptive as to the way that we can change these things to make it better. I was a 12-year old when I started smoking cigarettes, and they were 18 and over when I was a kid, and it never stopped me, and it didn't stop anybody. So, you know, we obviously, regulation, is important. Good parenting is more important, at the home front. You know, if, these kids are getting them from their parents more than, you know, picking up a coupon and buying them at the store. I feel that, you know, the, one of these amendments that you guys decided to take away actually, was one of the best things in it. You know, major grocery stores and these outlets are places where the kids are actually picking them up. These are huge stores where people shoplift. You know, if you go into an adult atmosphere, as in a liquor store or a vape shop or a tobacco place, you know, they look out of place when they're a young kid and they're walking into these shops. So, you know, it's kind of odd that I found that you guys took the one piece out that could actually help, I think, in the most beneficiary way. Again, like I said, I will be here. I think we can come up with a way better bill if we can just open discussions a little further. Again, like, I'm a father. I definitely don't want tobacco or nicotine in my children's hands. I've, you know, in all over the states, you know, they put regulations and taxes on nicotine solutions, which separated pure nicotine from these tobacco, these nicotine products, which makes it much more deadly. You know, pure nicotine buying online, you know, we're touching a lot of bases, but we need to do this correctly so that we don't put pure nicotine in the homes, and we make sure this stuff is, you know, away from children. So I do approve regulation. I don't believe that this is the bill to do so. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Members of the committee, my name is Taylor Jones. I am the lab manager for Vape Game in Eugene, Oregon. I'd like to point out that tobacco has been a blight on our, no question about it, tobacco has been a blight on our population as a whole. I got my degree in biology, emphasis in molecular and developmental. I worked for years in a bacterial host interaction lab. I have the background and the training to read scientific literature. I am up on it. Coming from human health science background into the vaping industry, I was weary at first. I've read a lot of the available literature. Vaping products do not contain all the harmful things that tobacco does. Tobacco as a whole leaf, before it's combusted, contains nitrosamines and other whole tobacco alkaloids and other components that are carcinogenic and dangerous. When you add the element of combustion inherent in the delivery system that is cigarettes, you multiply and compound the problem, and giving us the problem that we've had for the last 100 years that we've known about in the workplace and in the population of smokers, the deaths and the cost on the community. With vaping, you have pure nicotine, pharmaceutical-grade nicotine. We know if people are following the AMSA, American E-Liquid Manufacturing Standards Association, if we're following their guidelines, we know what every single molecule that's in these products. There's restrictions on certain chemicals that are allowed in some of the flavorings. There's restrictions on what type and grade of propylene glycol and vegetable glycerin you can use, and there's restrictions on the grade of nicotine. It has to be pharmaceutical grade. So we know what's in these. The negative studies that we've seen over the past year, the one that sticks out in my mind is the Portland State one, and what they did was they took, and they weren't finding anything, so they took the devices to failure state, which is not the method that people use them in. If people use them in failure state, they wouldn't use them at all. You wouldn't like it at all. You'd put it and you'd be like, oh my gosh, what's wrong with this thing? That's when they got the dangerous things. If you use an aerosol can in the wrong manner, you're going to burn your house down. People don't use that. We don't have restrictions on how people can use aerosol cans of hairspray because it's not necessary. If you level the playing field between tobacco and vaping, the vaping industry as a whole, especially here in the state of Oregon, is not, we're small businesses or smaller businesses, and we do not associate ourselves with big tobacco. We see them as the biggest adversary, not because they're a competitor in sales, but because they are doing harm. And if you level the playing field by relegating us to all the same regulations, you're inherently hurting our ability to be successful in helping our community's health, and that is actually helping big tobacco. So that's what this purpose is. And so I started smoking as a teenager because an older cousin of mine was smoking, and I thought he was the coolest person on earth. I never, ever was able to buy cigarettes as a minor, ever. I got them by having somebody else buy them or by having one of my friends stealing them from their parents or getting them freely from their parents. I was around a lot of teenagers that smoked. I applaud the efforts to get teenagers and minors off of tobacco products. I appreciate you bringing up the high school problem because I personally have a problem with seniors, which could be 18 years old, buying vaporizers and acting like they're cool at school. I have a 16-year-old daughter and I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I don't want either of them to be subjected to this as a social thing. I really hope that we can come to better terms on this legislation. I know that we've There's a very high likelihood that we'll be subjected to the Oregon Health Authority via the House Bill 2546, I think is the number. And I think that relegating us to a second is ineffective, unnecessary. And I think that if we needed to do something more than what's already being done in the House Bill, that we could better partner on that. I know that I had met with the writer of last year's bill in the House bill, and he had talked to us, me and my business partner, about joining talks on crafting better legislation. We never heard back from him and made calls and never heard back from him. We would have really loved to have been a part of that, especially since we have stores across the state, and we and I have scientific background and training to be able to talk about these things and the way people have compiled data and what actually would work for us in being able to stop big tobacco's hold and being able to provide a viable alternative within the range of what's acceptable.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee. My name is Tim Churchill from Medford, and I work with EC Blend. It's nice to see you guys again. We're opposed to the bill, the 663-2. We feel that it severely restricts the sales in Oregon, and it's going to be killing jobs. At EC Blend, we have over 125 employees, and with our projections for growth over the next few years, we will be adding hundreds of jobs to Oregon, 200 within the next 2 years. This bill will possibly force us to close our business or to move out of state.
I have a question. Why would licensing make you close your shop?
Well, it's the licensing is only part of it. And then there's the section for reducing prices and couponings. Every retail location, everybody has competitive customers around them or competitive stores. We have to be able to do that. We also have a huge internet market where we have to be competitive. If we cannot do that, we will be forced out of business. That's just a fact.
Madam Chair, if nobody's allowed to have discounts or coupons, why does it matter if you can't have discounts or coupons?
Well, what about our neighboring states? Is that going to be for across the whole U.S.?
Those are internet sales, and those would be regulated separately from this, and that's part of the conversation that's going on with the Department of Justice with their bill. That's a separate conversation.
And the cities that are close to Washington, Idaho, and California would all go to other states?
Well, that happens with a lot of other businesses currently now anyway. There's people who come to Oregon because we don't have sales tax either. So
you're correct. You are correct on that.
We need to hurry up. Is there any other questions that we have? Dee, do you want to quickly comment?
Yeah, real briefly. So the discounts, as it sits, if tobacco has had a long time to set pricing, they've got the minimum pricing they can have plus tax. It's really clear, right, what their price margin can be. What we have in our industry is variable margins, and we have certain products that are at full price, and then if they don't move, it's not like we have everything priced the same. It's like we have certain juice from different manufacturers that will not move until it's discounted. And it's not like we're passing out coupons to solicit sales. What we would like to be able to do is discount as our inventory needs or as competition around us would have it. It takes out the market, competition.
I understand. Okay. Thank you very much. All right, the final two people, Tim Schultz and Justin Rainey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Schultz. I've run a couple of shops in the Multnomah County and Washington County locations. You know, most have already been said, so I want to dial in on a couple of points. One of the things that we just was talked up kind of fits into one I wanted to talk about. Senator Cruz mentioned that the the OLCC is kind of an unwieldy beast, and I'd kind of agree. All these states that license tobacco don't do so with a beast of a bureaucracy like the OLCC. It's a simple tobacco license. Get pulled, you're not allowed to sell it.
Clarification, doesn't OHA regulate tobacco right now?
Currently.
Well, they don't regulate.
But they don't because there's no license.
Right.
And the enforcement's done by the state police, and they don't have much of a budget for it. And there's only a fine.
And while I understand, it kind of does make financial sense to put everything in together, one of the things with this bill is that you're trying to regulate devices and put sales on devices. And these devices, this industry, is a tech industry. Things go out of date within 3 to 6 months. Progressions are made. It's like telling a computer dealer or a cell phone dealer that because something's been on your shelf for 6 months, that you can't discount it to clear it out of your shop. And that right there is kind of a shop-type killer, is unable to move inventory. You don't regulate pipes for tobacco, and that's the analogy. You don't tax pipes for tobacco. Nothing with the device is done that way with marijuana either. That's those taxes and those types of things. You're not trying to regulate those types of devices. And if we want to put everybody on a level field, I don't think you should be regulating those for us either. It almost actually even punishes us in the long term. And that's all I have to say today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Justin Rainey, I'm here today on behalf of 7-Eleven today. Legislation that would require licensure for retailers to sell tobacco products or inhalant deliveries is something that we're currently opposed to with the bill as drafted. This is an additional license that businesses would need to apply for without addressing the key problems that lead to tobacco use among minors. We believe education and enforcement would go a great deal to solving this problem, or a lot further. The bill as drafted currently lacks clarity. It would make it harder for new convenience stores to secure licenses and to locate or open across the state. The legislation doesn't provide any clarity or certainty as to how the program would work. As written, if an employee makes a mistake and sells a tobacco product to a minor, would the owner of that business lose their license with one violation? The bill provides no clear criteria for what exactly would constitute a loss of licensure. Is it one violation? Is it a pattern of bad practices? Or would it be a complaint-driven system? We just don't know. Furthermore, the bill does not let us know what the cost for the licensure would be. It would allow the agency to set that by rule and raise it by rule.
Senator Steiner-Hairwood.
Sorry, just to clarify a couple of points, Mr. Rainey, I have a separate bill, Senate Bill, lost track, that we heard in Senate Business the other day that I believe will be moving, that would rename OLCC, but also has provisions in there to standardize regulations as much as possible across any substance that they regulate, so that it would ease the complications for businesses that sell more than one of these. Currently, my understanding, and somebody from OLCC can correct me if I'm wrong, that it's very rare for anybody holding a liquor license to lose their license for a first violation, and that would certainly not be my intention with this bill. I think that's unreasonable, and that's not what I would want. So I guess what I would say is I hear your concerns, but I don't want this to be unreasonable. I'm also perfectly happy to put on record that I would expect OLCC to come back to us in 2016 with a report on what they expected the license cost to be, so that the legislature could determine whether we thought they were reasonable and in line with appropriate business costs and enforcement costs. So I don't want this to be a revenue generator. I don't want it to be a revenue loss. I just want it to be revenue neutral, as other licenses, such as running a restaurant and having to have health permitting, running a nail salon and having to have permits to do that. I mean, pretty much any other kind of business has to have a license to do certain things or sell certain products, and that's what we're talking about here.
And Jesse Sweet, if he could take your place from OLCC.
Okay. And I appreciate the clarification, Senator. But, you know, we still would have other questions around the civil penalties. How would those be determined? It sort of goes into what you're talking about. Would you have a civil penalty before you'd lose a license? It's just unclear as the bill is written. Furthermore, the bill doesn't appear to give a retail owner or a store the ability to remedy the violation. All 7-Eleven stores participate in the We Card Under 18 program. They take training and education very serious for their employees, and they have a no-tolerance policy. If an employee sells to a minor, they're terminated. The other thing
but that Mr. Rainey, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I owe, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that, I owe Plaid Pantry an apology on the record, and I promised them I would do it on the record, and I want to do that. Last week when we heard Senate Bill 417 and Senator Byers' committee, I made a statement that I've since learned to be false, which is that my daughter had bought cigarettes at a Plaid Pantry. Turns out that there was a bunch of confusion. Either I misheard or she misremembered or some of the above. But the long story short is it wasn't a Plaid Pantry. I don't know where it was, but it wasn't the Plaid Pantry. So I wanted to put that on the record because they have made it clear that they do, as you're saying about 7-Eleven, take that very seriously. So I want to make that, I want to make that statement publicly.
Okay, go ahead.
And under 7-Eleven's policy, if a franchisee has more than two violations, they would be terminated, lose their franchise, and then they would come in and find someone else. So, you know, 7-Eleven takes this very seriously. We're concerned with the bill that it targets stores that are located within 1,000 feet. While some may be grandfathered in, we're concerned about the ability to transfer that license should a small business owner want to sell or want to locate. We would also be concerned for 7-Eleven after we've had a new franchisee come in based on own policies that they're no longer allowed to be there. Could we find another person to keep a store operating and running? So we're concerned with how that licensure would transfer. I guess the concern is the bill doesn't provide any certainty in those cases. You know, Oregon already has numerous existing laws that are designed to prevent youth tobacco use. These should be reviewed thoroughly before adding new provisions, and the legislature should explore ways to increase enforcement of the current laws and increase violations for don't comply. In Oregon, the state requires tobacco distributors to be licensed, and they sell those products to the Oregon retail stores. And the other thing I'll point out, too, is there's already penalties for noncompliance. Federal fines can be as high as $11,000. For violations, and we think $11,000 fine is definitely a reason for businesses to want to comply. I'll conclude and just talk a little bit about Section 5. The concerns that we have with that is essentially it's placing a hidden tax on Oregonians. Section 5 would prohibit the store from selling a tobacco product or inhalant delivery system at a reduced price. So, for example, it would prohibit the sale of a carton of cigarettes or make sure that it's consistent with what you're selling it for a normal pack of cigarettes. This is essentially a hidden tax for those smokers, many of which are the poorest of the poor. Smokers come from essentially 60% of smokers come from households that make incomes of less than $25,000 a year. So this would really impact people who can barely afford to buy food and other products.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm sorry, but I want to make the point here that I made last week when we were in the other committee. You know, this is the problem with taxes and talking about taxes on smoking or anything else, that anything that we become dependent on is, you know, when we become dependent on taxes that are on products that we don't want to be selling for public health purposes, then that puts us in a funny place. And I have to say, I find it a little ironic that that 7-Eleven is worried about cigarettes costing too much for poor people when the health costs, and you would think that 7-Eleven would want to be protecting the health of poor people. So I find that a little bit troublesome, to be honest. Thank you.
Okay. Well, those are some of the concerns. We feel the better approach would be to currently enforce the laws on the book and then to strengthen education around training for retailers to ensure compliance. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Justin. Any other questions for him? Jesse, do you want to just...
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Jesse Sweet with the OLCC. I wanted to provide just a little bit of clarifying information on two of these points. Regarding license fees, the bill directs the agency to charge a license fee that is reasonably calculated to cover the cost of the program administration. Based on our initial analysis, we believe that this license fee will be approximately $300 annually. Of course, that's subject to change as we do further analysis, but that is the initial estimate. The second point I would like to address is regarding penalties for administrative violations. As I understand the bill, we would have the authority to set these penalties in rule as we do for liquor law. And the penalty for the initial violation of sale to a minor for alcoholic beverages is either a 10-day license suspension or a civil penalty of $1,650. That is at the licensee's choice. And there are different programs which could affect that positively or negatively depending on the circumstances, but I just wanted to give some context for what the existing penalties are. They go on a matrix system and they go up from there.
And that's why I think we wanted to put in OLCC because they already have a system, which OHA does not. Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Richard Kosasan with the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, representing primarily small convenience stores throughout the state, like a Plaid Pantry, like a Dairy Mart, like a Jackson's Fuel, like Leather's Fuels, to name a few. I was trying to distribute a very short outline. Perfect. And I think there's a better way to approach this. Just in terms of, let's take a hard look in with respect to laws on the books. In the first page, I've outlined a few: endangering the welfare of a minor, distribution of tobacco to minors, retail signage, random inspections of tobacco retailers, possessions of tobacco by minors, purchased by minors, vending machines has been a debate over the years, and we've taken care of that. Location of tobacco products in retail stores, sales of tobacco through mail, mailing and shipping of tobacco, which is an interesting set of statutory provisions with respect to internet sales, public instruction, and prohibition against possession of minors at public facilities. There has been a great deal of discussion in terms of retailers not taking their responsibilities seriously. The second page is just an article out of the Business Journal from last year in terms of the improvement that retailers are doing with compliance checks. And in terms of getting back to a better avenue, we have compliance checks through the Oregon Health Authority. Retired state police are conducting those. That is one set of compliance checks, and that was started, I believe, in 2002 with the passage of House Bill 4172, which set up the retired state police as the inspectors or the checks and balances with those compliance checks. So that's one set. We have another set in terms of the SINAR, and it's been mentioned many times that the SINAR amendment in 92 requiring states to, one, pass laws prohibiting the sale or distribution of tobacco to minors. States were required to enforce such laws. States were required to do random, unannounced inspections. And states were also required to report back to the federal government on an annual basis. So that's another set of compliance checks. In 2009, the Federal Tobacco Control Act was passed. And that set up FDA in a manner to provide grants to different states for such compliance checks. That's a third set of compliance checks. As an example, I believe in the 14-15 federal fiscal year, FDA conducted 1,078 compliance checks in Oregon, and with a compliance rate of over 94%. And that is included in your packet. And I had two fiscal years noted.
Madam Chair, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I'm very confused because we've gotten two very different statements about compliance. And I wonder if we could ask OHA. We've heard this federal check come up several times, and then OHA gave very different. Would you mind if we could swap in and out? Because I want to make sure, because I'm getting confused. Thank you.
So, for the record, Michael Tynan from the Oregon Health Authority. I'm not an expert on the FDA investigations or compliance checks, but my understanding is from reviewing the database of FDA inspections, they didn't use any decoys in their inspections. So there's a tick on there that you can run the search of, about whether or not a decoy, minor decoy, was used or not, and it showed me zero. When I put no decoy, it showed me 1,000 inspections conducted. So we can get that data for you, to be clear. But that's the distinction within the SINAR checks that we run that show that there, I mean that OHA conducts, that has the 21% illegal sales to minors. There's a minor decoy who's used by the state police in that instance.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. Is that different from what you understand?
Well, according to the FDA compliance checks data that I handed you, it would look to me as though when it says fiscal year 2015 inspections involving a minor in Oregon, there were 1,080 checks made.
What does it mean inspections involving a minor if they don't use a decoy?
To my understanding, Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, it was my understanding that minors were involved with those inspections.
Okay, I'm going to ask you guys to sort that out and get it back to us, because it would be helpful to understand. Okay. Thank you.
In previous hearings, too, the reports from the SINAR inspections were referenced from 2013. I would encourage somebody to take a look at the 2014 data. But getting back to the FDA issue, in terms of a better avenue, since 2010, states have received grant funds. Oregon has received one grant fund in the amount of approximately $737,000, while California is at almost $9.6 million. Our neighboring state to the north is almost $4.9 million, and Idaho is at $2.4 million to do these compliance checks. With the statutory provisions we've had on the books for years, with a variety of compliance checks through the Oregon Health Authority, through FDA, to me it appears that we should take a look at enforcing what we have, reaching out perhaps in avenues like the FDA to secure additional dollars for compliance checks, work with retailers on an educational, informational basis. And I think great strides can be made. And I think if you look at the record of most retailers throughout the state, they operate their businesses in a very responsible and conscientious manner. Be happy to try to answer any questions. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good. All right. Thank you, everyone. I think it's been a very good session. And that is our last bill, correct? So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 663. And colleagues, we only have two more meetings. They may go late, just to be prepared. With that, we're adjourned.